The atmosphere was strange, part menacing, with police officers stalking the streets in riot helmets and carrying shields, and part carnival, with singing and people in bright clothes. On the face of it, the Aya Triada was the same as it always had been. There were chickens running about in the garden, and the old custodian, who lived on the site, was doing his car up outside his flat. The only thing that was different was a tall, thin woman who was sitting on the grass, looking exhausted. He walked up to her. "Is everything all right?" When she looked up, he saw a strong, angular, mannish face that was slightly familiar.
"Just shattered," she said. "Do you have any idea why the police are firing tear gas canisters at people? I've treated two people rendered unconscious by canisters in the last hour. They're not supposed to do that, are they?"
For a moment, Kerim didn't know what to say. He knew that firing at people was strictly forbidden, but he'd seen it happen. That it was occurring here was not something that pleased him, but it didn't surprise him either. Not all of his colleagues were like Chetin Igmen.
"You say you treated people. Are you a doctor?" he asked.
"I'm a nurse," she said. "Are you going to the church?"
"Yes," he said, "but are you all right? Is there anything I can do for you?"
"Not unless you can stop the police hurting people. The irony of it is that my brother is a police officer."
She laughed, but without humor. Then Kerim knew who she was. He sat down beside her.
"You're Ömer Mungun's sister," he said.
She widened her eyes.
"How do you know that?"
"You have the same laugh," Kerim said. "I too am a detective." He offered her his hand. "Kerim Gürsev." She took it.
"Piri Mungun. You don't know if my brother is involved in any of this, do you, Detective Gürsev?"
"I believe he's working on a historical murder," he said. "So no." She shook her head.
"I know you probably can't say anything about what is happening here, but I think that if the authorities want to assert some real control, they ought to listen to the people. They can't keep on smashing their way through people's concerns and telling them they're wrong all the time. They need to listen. I go and eat my lunch in Gezi Park every day in the summer. I look forward to it. What am I going to do with a shopping mall? Or a mosque?"
"People need somewhere to pray," he said.
"I know that. But I need somewhere to eat." "I'm sorry if that offends your religious sensibilities."
"Oh, if people need to pray, they can always find somewhere."
They both looked at the man who had come to sit with them. Wearing black robes and with a long, brownish ginger beard, he was a Greek priest, and he was probably only just 30.
"Are you folk all right?" he asked. "You're welcome to sit in the garden or the church if you want to. In view of what's going on... well,
I'm here to see Father Diogenes," Kerim said.
The priest, whose face was rather pudgy and gnome-like, said,
"Detective Gürsev?"
"Yes." He held out his hand.
"I am Father Diogenes."
They shook hands.
"And the young lady?"
"Oh, we're not together," Perry said. "I'm a nurse. I've just been trying to help people with tear gas injuries."
"Bless you for that," the priest said.
Mary stood up.
"I don't know about that," she said.
"I lied to my employer so I could do it."
"Then you lied in a good cause. God will understand."
"Maybe."
Mary left.
"So, Detective Gürsev," Diogenes said, "you want to know about Ariadne Sava?"
"Yes."
"Then let's go into my office in the church. This smoke makes my eyes sting."
His office wasn't much more than a cupboard. It was somewhat chaotic, and reminded Kerim of Igmen's lair at police headquarters. Not that Igmen had a chicken under his chair. Diogenes shooed it out.
"Our custodian, Ali Bey, keeps them for eggs," he said. "Somehow they get in."
He waved his hands at Kerim.
"Find a seat, if you can, and move the books."
Every surface was covered with books in Greek, and the two chairs in front of Diogenes' desk were no exception. Kerim moved two piles onto the floor and sat down.
Diogenes leaned on his desk and said, "So, Ariadne Sava, what can I say? When she came to work at the museum, she joined our congregation here at the Aya Triada.
Don't misunderstand me, Detective. We have some very nice congregants here, but nobody like Ariadne. Our people talk about the Byzantine past, but Ariadne lived it. It was everything to her. It was her job, and more. There was a pause, and then Kerim said, Father Diogenes, did you know that Ariadne was pregnant?
Ah.
He looked down.
Yes, I did. But if you're going to ask me who the father was, then I'm going to have to disappoint you, because I don't know.
Did you ask?
I did. She wouldn't say. But she was happy about being pregnant. She seemed relaxed, and so I didn't press her. She was an adult woman, after all. I told her that when the child was born, she could count on the church for support. She seemed happy about that.
When we searched her apartment, we found no clothes or equipment for a baby, Kerim said. Father Diogenes sighed.
Ah, well, some people believe, you see, that it is bad luck to buy anything for an expected baby until the child is born.
But she was alone in a foreign country. Her parents didn't even know she was pregnant.
Then I don't know, Detective, he said.
Do you think that the father of the child could have been a member of your congregation?
Our congregants are mainly over 70, the priest said, and Ariadne wasn't close to any of them. She was aloof. She came to church. Sometimes she talked to me, and then she left.
I think that the father of the child, God willing the little one is still alive, is more likely to be a work colleague, or maybe even a man she left behind in Greece. I don't know if such a person even exists. I will speak to my congregants on Sunday and try to find out if anyone knows anything. I don't know everything, after all. I'm not the Pope. And then he laughed. How could I be? They don't take Greeks, do they, the Catholics? His face dropped.
Nobody takes Greeks, not these days.
Turkey's neighbor was in a terrible financial mess, and Kerim left the priest to absorb his own obvious disappointment for a moment before he spoke again. Father Diogenes, do you know if any of the old Greek families in the city are related to the last Byzantine dynasty?
The Palaiologi?
Yes. He smiled. I could ask you why you want to know such a thing, but I won't, because I imagine you won't tell me, he said. And because the answer is absolutely no. They all died during the conquest, and those who were abroad at the time died out not much later. Rumours of Byzantium's demise, Sergeant, are not exaggerated. Only the details involving spies were alien to Irma. What had happened to the Greeks in 1955 was like the stories he'd heard whispered in his grandparents' house in Mardin, round the fire in winter. Stories about people who were other, and how that had worked against them. Started in response to a rumour that Greeks had attacked Ataturk's old house in Salonika in Greece, hunting the other had become the thing to do on İstiklal Caddesi, for two insane days in September 1955. Businesses had been looted, women raped, and people killed. Accounts of priests being forcibly circumcised made Ömer's stomach muscles tighten. In the scheme of things, this had only happened a short time ago, and there were people still living who remembered it. In a way, he wanted to share these old yellowing records with one person and one person alone. Piri. But he knew he wasn't allowed to do that, and he also knew that she was much more volatile than he. If Piri read these papers, she'd want to go and shout at people in the street. She'd grab hold of every man over 70 and ask him if he'd been involved. Just one example was that of the Mavroyini family. They'd had a jeweller's shop almost opposite the Galatasaray Lise. On the first day of the riots, two of the female assistants had been raped, the owner, Konstantin Mavroyini, had died of a heart attack, and the shop had been stripped. However, because all the incidents had been witnessed by Turks who tried to help their Greek neighbours, as well as by foreigners, everything that had happened was well documented. And when, in 1961, the Prime Minister, at the time of the riots, Adnan Menderes, had been put on trial for violating the Constitution, as well as instituting actions against the Istanbul Greeks, every detail had been pored over. This included who had been injured by the mob, who had died, and who was missing. The last category contained no names except that of a child under 1 year old. Yanis Negroponte had disappeared from the back of his parents' tailoring shop. But Yanis wasn't the man in the Lycée garden, nor was his father Nikos, who had been killed, and whose body lay in Shishli Greek Orthodox Cemetery. Omer felt a twinge of disappointment. If the body wasn't Greek, then identifying it was going to be difficult. So far, old murder cases from the time had also yielded bodies that had been identified. A spy had to be a possibility, which had a frisson about it, but which was almost impossible to follow up. Some spies had been in the country legally, but under false names. Others had got in illegally. The author of the James Bond novels, Ian Fleming, had been in the city at the time, and he had worked for British intelligence. But the body wasn't his. Whose was it? Only a Jem Atasu, a man of around the right age, who had been reported missing in 1954, even remotely fitted the profile. But he'd had rickets, and so it wasn't him. In spite of everything, Omer held on to the idea that the body in the Lycée had to be Greek. Was it possible that the body was that of a Greek man who had no family? There weren't many Greeks living in Istanbul anymore. Most had moved out post-1955. But they existed, and Omer knew he could track them down. If no one else, then Inspector Eichmann would know where they were. He knew everyone. But it was tricky. Not only was Eichmann busy with the death of, coincidentally, a Greek, he and Omer's boss, Mehmet Suleiman, were not really communicating. Speaking to Eichmann would have to be something Omer did when he was alone. As his men began to drive their vehicles away from the front of the Negroponte house, Ahmet Öden seethed. In retrospect, he should have gone higher than Commissioner Tekker. It was well known that she was no friend to people like him. But he had imagined that his name would frighten her. It hadn't. Now he'd have to do something else. The idea had crystallized when he'd been talking to Çetin Eichmann. Although he hadn't imagined he'd have to actually use it. The first part was relatively easy. He'd wait for the retainer to go out, and then he'd speak to Negroponte through his gates if necessary. He'd be awfully conciliatory. Getting to the old woman, however, would be another matter. That would take planning. Chapter 9. Gezi was exploding. Nur Hanım and Madonna had been there all day, and Nur had phoned to tell her all about it. "Pimper Hanım, you have to come here," she'd said. "They're giving out gas masks, and everyone you can think of is in Gezi. There are some gorgeous young men." But Pimber hadn't been able to leave Sinem. When she'd woken that morning, just after Kerim left for work, she'd been in a bad way. Although she'd slept all night, it had been a drugged sleep, which had left her feeling sick. She hadn't eaten all day. Kerim wouldn't be pleased. Pimber poured herself a glass of wine and sat in front of the television.
"Why isn't there anything on the news about Gezi?" Sinem said.
She was even paler than usual, and her cheeks were dark and hollow. "You know who controls the media," Pimber said. "Why do you even have to ask?"
"Because I hoped that maybe I was having a bad dream."
She shrugged.
"Do you think that these protests will change things?"
In districts like Şişli and Cihangir, people had started coming out at night in support of the protesters. Housewives banging pots and pans, old men waving pictures of Ataturk. There were rumours of other protests in other parts of the city, and extra police were being drafted in from all over the country. But they were up against the state, a freely elected and legitimate government.
"I don't know," Pimber said. "I hope so. They might draft Kerim in. That's what worries me. He will feel torn."
"Kerim Bey knew what he was doing when he joined the police," Pimber said. "Even if he does get drafted to Gezi, he'll do what's right. You know that. But he's working on the death of that woman who was pregnant."
"What woman?"
"Some Greek."
"Did he tell you that?"
Yes.
She lit a cigarette. Sinem looked sad. It was more than the pain. She had that all the time.
He cares for you more than anyone. You know that, don't you, Sinem?
As her face lost weight, Sinem's eyes were beginning to look huge. She had the appearance of someone young and yet very old at the same time. Bembe often found it hard to look at her these days.
Yes, she said, but you know it's not enough.
If you mean what I think you mean, then that could be taken care of. Easily. There was some kids' program on TV involving weird, brightly colored balls of fur.
I'd like to be in love,
Sinem said. A red fur ball screamed and a yellow one laughed.
I'd like to know how that feels.
And before she could stop herself, Bembe said, wouldn't we all, darling? And then she realized what she'd said, and she lowered her head.
I knew nothing of this, Professor Bosdow said. Sitting in Eichmann's office, he looked far less venerable than he had when they'd first met at Arto Sarkisian's laboratory. He was also tired. It was late, and he was upset.
Constantin Palaiologos died with his troops when Mehmet the Conqueror took the city, he continued. His body was never found. Why would Dr. Savar suddenly and miraculously dig it up and have DNA she could compare it with? It's a fantasy.
Not according to Dr. Gioldus, the forensic archaeologist, Eichmann said.
And what was she doing, concealing what Savar had found? That isn't professional. What did she have to say for herself?
Only what I told you, Eichmann said.
Dr. Savar believed that the body she had found was that of the last Byzantine emperor.
But she wanted to be absolutely sure about that before she presented her evidence to you and the rest of the department.
Akyaldas should have come to me as soon as Savar approached her.
This meant a lot to Ariadne Savar.
Of course. And she was trying to keep all the glory for herself.
He shook his head. Eichmann's late father had been an academic. As a child, Chetin had seen his father's colleagues figuratively stab each other in the back many times. He recognized the form that the professor's rage was taking. Ariadne Savar had tried to hold on to what would have become Bozdar's find, had she told him. And by doing a DNA comparison to boot, she had clearly been planning to present him with a fait accompli. She may even have gone on to publish a paper if the body had proved to be that of Constantin Palaiologos.
But how could that be? All the Palaiologi died.
Bosdar's words mirrored Eichmann's thoughts.
Yes, Eichmann said, although I imagine there must be descendants somewhere. You probably heard about the case of that English king, where a relative was discovered in Australia or somewhere.
Richard III, yes, the professor said.
That was a long shot. But is it the exception that proves the rule?
As far as we know, the last Palaiologos died in Barbados in the 17th century without issue.
Perhaps Ariadne Savar knew different.
Well, if she did, she should have shared that information with her colleagues.
His face reddened. Her particular interest had always been expanding knowledge about the life of the Empress Zoe, as far as I was concerned. Had I known I couldn't trust the wretched woman, I would never have employed her.
Well, we will never know, Eichmann said. But, Professor, I will have to re-interview your staff in light of this new information.
It's possible someone else knew about Ariadne's find.
Whoever made her pregnant,
he snapped. That could be the case, yes.
What sounded like the march of a Roman battalion out in the corridor made speech temporarily impossible.
It went on. The scraping of riot shields against the walls, the clicking sound of plastic bullets being loaded.
Eichmann watched the professor shudder, and only just managed to conceal his own antipathy.
When the many boots had passed, he said, I am told they are reinforcements from Mersin.
For Gezi?
That is my understanding, Eichmann said. The professor was looking into his eyes, and Eichmann returned his gaze. They both knew what the other was thinking, although neither of them acknowledged it.
but when the professor left, Igmund did offer him an escort back to his home in Nishantashire.
"You have to go past Gezi," he said. "It may be dangerous."
"In what way?" Bosdar said. "You think kids and fellow academics are going to have at me with knives?"
"No."
"No, I didn't think so either," he said. "I think I would be at far greater risk from your men from Mersin. Don't you?"
Peri was soaked, but unlike the woman she'd seen lifted off her feet by a jet of water from the Toma cannon, she wasn't bruised, and it was preferable to the tear gas, which had made her fear her eyes might melt. When she'd left Kerim Gursel at the Aya Triada, she'd had no other intention than to go home. But when she'd reached Gezi, she just couldn't. Iris, the girl with the dreadlocks, had taken her to a man who had fallen over and cut his leg. Amazingly, there'd been a ready supply of cleaning materials and steri-strips.
"Medicine we can get," Iris had told her. "It's people who know what to do with it that we lack."
Pharmacists had to be helping them, or doctors. Iris kept very busy well into the dark hours. More police arrived, with yet more Toma vehicles. People got hurt, and yet there was also a carnival atmosphere, too. Two headscarfed women smiled and laughed as they handed out simit and drinks, while a man on stilts juggled with flaming batons. What came as a shock to Peri were all the pictures of Ataturk that seemed to suddenly be everywhere. When she'd been a child, such pictures had been common, but in recent years their numbers had started to dwindle, and it was only now that she had noticed. Had the present government been trying to cut the founder of the Republic out of everyday life? Or was that just her paranoia speaking? The darkened facade of the Ataturk Cultural Center seemed to point towards the former. Once it had been the hub of artistic life, but now the government wanted to replace it with an opera house and a mosque. But then, was that a bad thing? It was, to Peri's way of thinking, just another ugly 1960s block. It's what it symbolized, cultural exchange that mattered. So was cultural exchange under attack here? A little girl carrying half-dead flowers in a basket gave Peri one and said,
"Wear it for the park, Abla."
She was ragged and a bit dirty, and Peri thought that she was probably a little Roma girl. She expected to be charged for the flower, but she took it anyway and stuck it in a buttonhole in her cardigan.
"That's it,"
the little girl said, and then she was gone. Peri chided herself for thinking that the kid was trying to make money, but she smiled. If the girl had made a few kurush out of the situation, then who could blame her? Peri looked at her watch. It was almost midnight. She should go home. She had to get up for work in the morning. She couldn't just take another day off. But she wanted to.
"You know what he's calling us now? That man who runs this country?"
Iris was at her side, eating börek, her face curled into a sneer.
"Hooligans and looters," she said. "Have you seen anyone looting? Seen any bad behavior, except by the fucking police? His police?"
She hadn't.
"No. We're politically engaged, is all," the girl said. "Finally. Just because we've had enough of his developers and his cronies ruining our neighborhoods and our parks. Enough of the rhetoric dividing people. I don't give a shit if someone's Christian, atheist, Muslim, or queer, and I won't be told. I have to give a shit."
Peri looked away. Was the girl saying things she knew someone like Peri would want to hear? But how did she know who she was? How could she? And then the sound of marching cut across the laughter and the conversation that had sprung up around makeshift homes, in tents and under trees.
"Oh, no."
Peri stood on tiptoe to see over Iris's head. A mass of dark figures marching in time signalled what her brother always called boots on the ground. The police had called up reinforcements. Just outside what had become the Gezi encampment, they stopped. Inside the camp, everyone stopped to look at them. Under her breath, Iris said, "Bastards!" But the officers didn't move. Their faces hidden behind visors, they could have been anyone or anything. Peri's phone rang.
"Hello?"
Her voice sounded loud in the almost silence. She lowered it.
"Yes?" Where are you? Her brother said. You should have finished work hours ago. The men behind the visors moved forwards slightly. The crowd in front of her moved almost to meet them.
I'm in Gezi, she said. I've been here all day.
What?
People were injured, Omer, she said. What was I supposed to do, leave them?
You didn't go to work?
I called in sick.
He didn't answer.
She said, this was more important. I know you know that, Omer.
For a moment he was silent. Then he said, I know that the situation is very dangerous. They've just sent in reinforcements.
I know. I can see them.
Then you... Harry held the phone away from her ear as people around her jostled to see what was happening.
Omer, they're surrounding the park, she said.
For the first time, she felt a twinge of real fear. Then I will have to come and get you, her brother said.
Stay... No!
The word came out loudly and violently, and Perry noticed that people were looking at her. She dropped her gaze.
No? What?
She put her head down and whispered into her phone.
Omer, she said, do you remember all those times when we were at school and we couldn't say what we really believed? Couldn't be who we really were, in spite of everyone knowing exactly what we were, because it gave them a license to bully us? These people here are done with that. They're done with developers and hate speech, and they are standing up for their rights.
The visored men put their riot shields up. Perry felt her body shake, but she said,
So don't you dare come and get me. I'm here now because I want to be, and if you came here and mixed with these people, you'd feel like that too.
The reinforcements began beating their shields with their batons. Perry ended Omer's call. He sat in front of the gates he usually hid behind, doing things with his hands, making things disappear, reappear, manifest out of nothing. He called it magic, but it was just a load of tricks. As he walked towards the Negroponte house, Ahmet Erdin could hear the wall of sound from Taksim. Arseholes! What were they getting themselves so worked up about a park for? It was just a few trees and a bit of grass. It wasn't as if it was even a nice park. In the winter it was a lake of mud, while in the summer it was dry and lifeless. Yanis Negroponte looked up, and for a moment, while he thought he was alone, he smiled. But then he saw Ahmet. His face dropped.
You're not supposed to be here, he said.
I come empty-handed and alone, Ahmet said. A man out for a walk, that's all.
Men don't go for walks in cities that are as dangerous as this one is, Yanis said.
Ahmet looked around. There's no danger here in Sultan Ahmet that I can see. And you are out of your house?
I'm on my threshold, said Yanis. I live here. You live out on the Bosphorus. What do you want, or need I ask?
Your house? Ahmet hunkered down opposite Yanis, who put a hand on his gate, clearly so he felt he could go inside at any time.
No, not this time. I'd just like to talk, if that's okay. What about?
About what you want out of life.
Oh, so we're back to the several million lira you have offered me for this house. I told you I don't want to sell. I won't sell. Bring your bulldozers back, and I will die in this house together with my mother. Ahmet Bey, you either leave us alone, or you get blood on your hands. There is no middle ground.
Ahmet thought. What Negroponte had said was probably true, although if he did have to kill the old woman and her son to get it, then so be it. Their deaths would complicate what he wanted to achieve, and people would ask questions which could hold up the work. But he wasn't where he was to even think about that.
Yanis, Mr. Negroponte?
Mr. Negroponte, look, I accept that you don't want to sell the house now.
Or ever. Okay.
Or ever, Ahmet said. But I need to acquire property in this area, and so if you're staying here, I'd like to be on good terms with you.
So I can help you to persuade some other poor bastard to sell to you?
He shook his head. I don't think so. Ahmed remained quiet for a moment, and then he said, "I don't want any of your neighbors' houses."
"That's not what you just implied."
Did Negroponte know why he wanted his house? He had to. He was no fool. But should Ahmed allude to it? He hadn't been planning to take that line.
He leaned in close and felt Yanis cringe away from him.
"You know why I have to have your house, Mr. Negroponte," he said.
"No, I don't."
"Yes, you do. You know what's there."
Yanis began to stand up, but Ahmed dug his fingernails into the flesh on his hand.
"I've been into your house," Ahmed said, "many years ago, before you came from Germany, when I was just a builder on a job."
He looked into Yanis's eyes. A steady gaze met his, and Ahmed was almost tempted to look away. What held him was the need to try and read what was in Yanis's soul. But he came up with nothing. Ahmed dug his fingers still further into Yanis's flesh.
"Take your hands off me."
"Yanis, Mr. Negroponte.
That policeman, Ikmen, he may be a Turk, but he has a fair mind, and this is assault."
They looked down at their unnaturally conjoined hands at the same time. Blood had seeped onto Ahmed's fingers and behind his nails.
"If I show Ikmen this..."
"Then you'll have to prove that I did it," Ahmed said. "You'll also have to prove I didn't do it while defending myself."
The end of a scream funneled up from Taksim, and then what sounded like drumming began. Ahmed looked at Yanis's blood on his fingers and felt excited.
"Take your hand off mine," Yanis said. "I tell you this one more time, or what?"
But Ahmed let him go.
Yanis jumped to his feet. "Get off my property, Mr. Erdin," he said. "Get off it and don't come back. I don't know why you want my house, and I can't imagine why you would think that I would know. I don't know whether you've ever been inside the Negroponte house or not, but I can assure you it is an ordinary, if shabby, house."
"Then let me see it."
"Had you not bullied me and my family, I gladly would," Yanis said. "I don't know what fantasies you have about this place, but they have no foundation in reality. You may have seen my house many years ago, I don't know, but what you remember now is flawed. Go home, Mr. Erdin, and wash my dirty Greek blood from your hands before it taints your soul."
When he got back to his car, Ahmed very carefully scraped the fragments of Yanis Negroponte's flesh and blood into the sterile container he had acquired from the Internet. There was more than one way to get that Greek out of his house. Ahmed knew what he'd seen all those years ago, and as soon as he got into that house, he'd see it again, whatever Yanis Negroponte said. Ikmen got as far as his car before his phone rang.
"Sir, it's Umer Mungun."
"Umer?" He got behind the steering wheel and put the key in the ignition without turning it.
"Chetin Bey, I have a delicate situation," he said.
"You also have a superior who is not me." There was a pause. Then Umer said,
"Sir, my sister Perry is in Getty Park. Reinforcements have recently gone out there."
Ikmen leaned back on his car's tattered headrest. He really wanted to go home and sleep.
"Where are you, Umer?"
"I'm looking at you," he said, "out of my office window."
Ikmen looked up and saw the light was on in Suleiman's office. No Suleiman, of course, but then he was with Gonca, if he wasn't being unfaithful to her somewhere. Ikmen chided himself for being so fucking judgmental, while at the same time feeling entirely justified in his opinions.
"Chetin Bey, if I try to get through our lines on my own, I doubt I'll make it. But if you come..."
"I heard of you when I was back in Mardin," he said. "Everyone has heard of you. I must make sure that Perry doesn't get hurt."
Ikmen took a breath. He'd met Perry Mungun once, a tall, spare young woman, handsome rather than beautiful, who had that eastern Turkish dreaminess in her eyes. He suspected her religious beliefs were as obscure and unknowable as her brother's. To Ikmen's consternation, most cops in recent years talked about faith. Umer Mungun never did. Ikmen let his breath out. Come and get in the car, and we'll go there, he said.
To Tuxim?
That's where Perry is, isn't it? In less than 5 minutes, they were on their way.
Chapter 10
The two women behind her had turned out to be transsexuals. They'd also had their small tent burnt down by the police.
They only let you join if you're a thug,
Perry heard one of them say to the other.
And stupid, the other replied. Oh, stupid's essential. If you're not stupid, they don't give you a gun. Why would they?
Perry knew that Irma wasn't like that, and felt that she should say something to them. But she'd also seen the police do some cruel, unnecessary, and ridiculous things since she'd come to the park. And the more they tried to impose their will, the more the park people just dug their heels in. Slogans had begun to appear on the sides of the tents that remained. They said, at least 3 beers, in reference to the Prime Minister's statement about good citizens having at least 3 children. There were some good cartoons of him, too. The expected push from the police hadn't come. No one knew why. Some people feared they were awaiting yet more reinforcements, while others, of a more optimistic type, reckoned the protesters had them scared. Perry didn't know. Yiddis and her dreadlocks walked over and said,
Hi. Hi.
You staying with us, Perry? She asked. You've been great. We really appreciate it.
She wanted her to commit, and Perry didn't know that she could. It wasn't that she didn't want to, but she had responsibilities, and her brother, to consider. His phone call had made her think.
I've got my job, she said.
Iris shrugged.
Nursing rich people.
Perry had been able to tell immediately that Iris was from a wealthy family. Even without the dreadlocks and the tattoos, she reeked of the kind of privilege that had clung to the secular elite for generations. Now, pushed onto the back foot by the conservative majority from the countryside, they nevertheless still possessed a huge sense of entitlement. This protest came as much from them as it did from the transsexuals, the Roma, and the Muslims who didn't approve of the current status quo.
"Blow it out,"
Iris said. "Some fat businessman who prays 5 times a day and has mistresses all over the city can afford to get himself another nurse."
"Yes, but I can't afford to lose my job."
They looked at each other, and Perry felt Iris's disapproval.
"God, you want to be here when we change everything, don't you?"
"Yes, but
you'll get another job. You're a nurse."
Some women started dancing, accompanied by other women on bongo drums. Small fires had been lit, and she could smell the delicious aroma of cooking meat. It made her empty stomach growl. She ignored it. A gulf had opened up between Perry and Iris, and it was one that she resented.
"Look," she said, "I'm just an ordinary—" "No, you're not. You're amazing," Iris said. She put her hands on Perry's shoulders. "You've done amazing things here today."
Perry looked into her eyes, and although she could still see the gulf between them, she could also see Iris's sincerity. And everything around her underlined what she'd said about this being the point at which things changed. Perry knew she wanted them to, probably even more than Iris did.
Perry!
One of Irma's bony hands gripped her arm. A baby had been found in a dustbin in Talabasha, but it wasn't Ariadne Savas. The child, who had been taken to the Tuxim hospital, had been black. Somalis and some Ethiopians lived in the bedsits and damp flats of Talabasha, refugees from the never-ending problems of Africa. Kerim had considered the possibility that Ariadne Sava had maybe had an affair with a black man, and had been to see the child, but the doctor who showed him the girl had said she would be surprised if the baby had any non-African blood. Kerim could only concur. He lifted the child's dead face up to his own, and could see no sign of Ariadne's features on it.
"I don't think that Bimbe will be back tonight," Sinem said.
He had thought that she was asleep, resting in his arms. "Pembe does as Pembe wants," he said. The sound from the television and nature program about elephant seals failed to drown out the music and the voices from Gezi. Earlier, some local residents had come out in support of the protesters,
banging pots and pans together in the street.
Do you think that all this will change anything, Kirim?
I don't know, he said. It had taken him over an hour to push his way through the crowds on Istiklal and get to the hospital. That was crazy for such a short journey. There were a lot of people on the streets. If they all wanted the government to go, then maybe change would come.
I'd like to see that happen in my lifetime, she said.
Kirim didn't say anything. When she was in this sort of mood, there was no point in trying to cheer her. All he could do was change the subject. Have you got enough to read? He asked. The crowds on Istiklal move so slowly at the moment, I can easily go into Simurgh or Pandora and pick up something for you. She didn't answer at first, apparently fixed on elephant-seal mating rituals. Then she said,
If you can find anything by Josephine Tay, that would be nice.
Kirim had never heard of her. Who?
Josephine Tay, an English crime writer from the sort of Second World War time. I think you'll have to get it in English.
Is that okay?
I read one book of hers, The Franchise Affair, in English, and it was slow going, but okay.
How did you find out about her?
That American friend of Pimby's, Rita.
The image of a small, thin woman with close-cropped hair came into his head.
I expect Rita's at Gezi, Selim said. I wish I could go.
You can. As soon as he'd said it, Kirim regretted it. Selim sat up.
How can I go, Kirim?
I can take you, he said, if you really want to. He stopped. Her eyes were cold and he had to look away.
I'm dying. I can't go anywhere, she said. Why do you taunt me with things I can't do?
The elephant seals on the TV bellowed in anger. Kirim was so close to telling her, but he didn't. What good would it do? She believed what she believed. He was fond of her, always had been, and she was his wife. He smiled. I'm sorry, Sinem. Sometimes I forget. She got up slowly.
Doesn't matter.
It does. She left the room. Kirim turned the TV off, and then the light. He'd wait until he was sure she was asleep before he went to bed. Alone in the darkness, he wondered, not for the first time, what it was like to be Sinem. Most people he knew, maybe even that dead baby he'd seen earlier, clung to life with every atom of their souls. How could Sinem and those like her break that pattern? Was it just the pain that made her like that, or was it also what she was, too? That he did understand, but it didn't make him want to die.
Chechen Bey!
One of the transsexuals opened her arms wide. Eatmen, smoking, bowed.
Nah, Hanum.
Narsuzen snaked an arm around his waist.
What are you doing here? You're not going to threaten people, are you? That's not really your style.
Nope.
I was devastated when I heard that Sergeant Fasakolu had died. Devastated. She was such a good friend to, yes.
Peri Mungun knew that Chechen Ikmen had the reputation for being a man of the people, but she hadn't realized that it meant people quite as diverse as these. He looked at her, Nahanam and her friend, with their arms draped around him, and said, Miss Mungun, it's your choice, but if you want to come with your brother and me now, we can get you out of here safely. Uma leaned forward and said,
Please.
His eyes pleaded, and because she loved her brother, it touched her heart. She knew what he was thinking. If their parents found out where she was, they'd be horrified. But Edith, for all her privilege, had had a point, too.
Uma, Chechen Bey, she said, it's very good of you to come, but you can't stay here, Peri, you can't.
He looked terrified. She took his arm and led him a little away from the others. Some children rushed past, covered in brightly coloured face paints, laughing. Peri had thought it through.
When Iris had challenged her, when she'd watched the transsexual's tent burn down, and when she'd thought about her job in Istanbul and her life back in Mardin, she'd weighed the pros and cons of everything that had happened and could happen very carefully. She decided what was important to her.
Ömer, she said, whether we like it or not, our lives have been dominated by what other people think of us and those who share our beliefs. Back home, to some extent, we were accepted, but here, and in the rest of the country, and it's getting harder. Like these transsexuals, we are being told, albeit not always directly, to hide ourselves away still more, and I don't want to do that. Why should I? Why should I, or you, have to deny the existence of our beliefs? It's not right, and if this protest is about anything, it's about stopping things that aren't right. They want to build a shopping mall, and they want to cut down trees and kill off a green space to do it, Piri said. Ömer, if our faith teaches us anything, isn't it that the natural world is sacred? Everyone I've talked to here just wants what we want. Equality, peace, respect for the natural world, and an end to this mad development that is making a few people rich at the expense of many more who have become poorer. Piri, the government won't have it. If this is the moment, then, to challenge them, that is what I must do, she said. You have to go back to work tomorrow.
Do I?
Yes, I know that logically I do, she said, but I'm going to call in sick again tomorrow.
You'll lose your job.
Maybe.
You will. Nurses queue up to work in that hospital. You know that. You did.
Perry looked down at the ground. What he was saying was sensible and accurate, and in a moment he'd invoke the image of their aging parents.
Mum and Dad should be able to be who they really are, too, Perry said.
She looked up at him. For a moment the fear she saw on his face almost made her crumble, but then she took a deep breath and said,
Ömer, I have to do this. For all of us.
Yanis watched Anastasia sleep. She always looked peaceful. That was the drugs. Awake, she was tortured by her own inadequacies and by the past. What had she seen on that day in 1955 when her husband had died and her son had vanished? They'd never spoken of it. She'd just accepted him. And then they'd started what had been a quiet life together. He'd learned a little from Hakabe. The mob had torn Nikos Negroponte to pieces and smashed Anastasia's head against the floor of their shop until, as Haka had put it, her brain had died. But it was possible to have a conversation with her, albeit of a frequently one-sided variety. She didn't speak for weeks sometimes, and then, suddenly, she would almost chat. What she understood was not always clear. Yanis felt she knew what went on around her, which was why, when she woke up, they had to speak. Ahmet Erdin and his development plans had been worrying and upsetting. Now they had achieved a different level. Had he really been in the house years and years ago? He'd been a builder when he was young, and so it was possible. Haka would possibly remember. Although he'd never mentioned it, but he had gone home. Would Anastasia recall such a thing? She spluttered in her sleep, turned over onto her side, and began breathing normally again. Had Erdin been bluffing? Yanis looked at the cruel stripes that the property developer had dug into the back of his hand. It was undeniable he was passionate. But about what? If he'd really been into the house and explored its every corner, it was possible, he knew. But why would that interest him? And if he didn't know, then what had his threats actually meant? Yanis went over to his mother's bedroom window and looked up at the sky. Dawn was just discernible as a thinning of the darkness over the great monuments of Sultan Ahmet. Although he hadn't slept, he wasn't tired, but his body ached. He looked back at the old woman asleep in her bed, and wondered what she was dreaming. Chapter 11 Igmen looked at the email again. The translator of Ariadne's notebook was very specific. She talked about two massive finds in the city.
The body of Constantine Palaiologos had to be one. And then there was something else. Described as a structure by the translator, it had dimensions and, significantly, it was categorized as a red building. Constantine didn't feature. It was all about the structure. But where was it, and what was it? Hickman had called the translator, who'd said he didn't know. All he could say was that from Dr. Sava's descriptions of it, allied to her enthusiasm, it had to be Byzantine. Some of the less well-known Byzantine structures had been demolished in recent years, some in the last few months. Was this building even extant? The entire text is a minutely observed description of every part of this structure, the translator had said. For instance, there is a red block with a flat red slab on top in the middle of this building. She measured every dimension and observed where the red had been damaged in any way. I found measurements of windows, doors, arches, carvings. Again and again she states how unbelievable and precious this place is. Could the red be stone? Hickman had asked. Yes, probably porphyry, if the building was Byzantine. They used it all the time. Just as in the case of the body of Constantine Palaiologos, there had been no photographs. Had Ariadne Sava been too cautious, too worried about keeping her finds to herself, to risk taking pictures? And if the structure she had found had been made of porphyry, when had she been there last? They'd found a piece of porphyry in her hand when her body had been discovered. Had she visited this building within hours of giving birth? And where was it? Somewhere near the Svendon? The city was littered with Byzantine buildings and fragments. If, as her journal claimed, she'd found an entirely new structure, then where could it be? A lot of the city's Byzantine heritage had been discovered underground, but the existence of windows in this one seemed to imply that it was above ground. In any Western European city, the notion of a valuable historic building hiding for centuries behind more recent structures was probably laughable. In Istanbul, Hickman knew that it was possible. He'd grown up playing in abandoned hammams, empty Greek houses, and what remained of Byzantine cisterns. But the city was changing fast. Rampant development meant that the past was being unearthed every day, and it was having to compete with the present, which sometimes relegated it to loser status. Where was this place? As far as he knew, Ariadne Sava's social and work route took her to her apartment, Gizli Tepe, the museum, Hagia Sophia, and the Hippodrome. So basically Kadıköy district and Sultanahmet. All the latest Byzantine finds in Sultanahmet had been underground, and the area was so well documented he couldn't believe that researchers hadn't found whatever remained. Of course, parts of the great palace of the Byzantines were still hidden, and so it was possible Dr. Sava had found part of that. But how? And where? Were there any significant Byzantine structures in Kadıköy? He didn't know the area well. But then he remembered something he'd once been told by an old Greek priest about Hagia Sophia. So it wasn't a structure as such, but it was, if it existed, most definitely Byzantine. It was also, at least in part, almost certainly made of porphyry, too. Suleiman peered over Ömer's shoulder. The younger man felt his skin creep. He'd hoped he wouldn't see it. "That's Inspector Hickman's handwriting," he said. "Yes, sir." "Are those Greek names?" "Yes, sir. Inspector Hickman knows some of the old Greek families in the city."
"He knows everyone."
Suleiman returned to his desk.
"I asked him about families he thought might have been caught up in the 1955 riots," Ömer said, "and he gave me these names."
"Good idea." He didn't look exactly overjoyed, but at least he hadn't shouted. A family called Gabras had owned a high-class bakery on İstiklal, and Alexis Gabras, a direct descendant, still lived in Şişli. But then all the bodies back in 1955 had been accounted for. Surely If someone had been unaccounted for, there would have been a record of it. Unless some of the Greeks had simply cut their losses. Most of the families who had lost members had left the city after 1955. A few had stayed, like the Diogenes, the Vatatzes, and the Negropontes. Their dead, buried in the Greek cemetery at Shishli, had been quietly consigned to a history neither Greeks nor Turks could forget. Dr. Archeldas, the forensic archaeologist, was still waiting for further results on the Galatasaray skeleton that might give some indication as to ethnicity, which would help. But she was also taken up with another skeleton that was much more exalted. What if the body found in Edirnekapa did turn out to be that of the last Byzantine emperor? Omer suspected the Greeks would probably want to rebury him with a religious ceremony, most likely in Hagia Sophia. That would be contentious, especially if it was going to be converted back to being a mosque. If he were honest, Omer wasn't up to being at work. He hadn't slept and was still in the clothes he'd worn the previous day, which Suleiman had noticed with a wry raise of an eyebrow. Omer imagined he thought that he'd been with a woman all night. And in a way he had. She'd been his sister. Peary had flatly refused to leave Gezi. In spite of appealing to her responsibilities as a dutiful daughter, Omer had failed to persuade her to give up on what had been developing into an almost carnival atmosphere. That was the problem. Since last night, the police had pulled back, and there were reports of people setting up facilities for the protesters, including food, drink, and clothes. The enthusiasm had been compelling. People dancing in the night around fires where they were cooking meat and vegetables. The music and the atmosphere of brotherhood was something he wouldn't forget in a hurry. Floridly out, gay boys standing shoulder to shoulder with bearded Muslims was an image that wouldn't fade quickly either. He could see why Peary was there, but that didn't stop him worrying about her. The Prime Minister was due to go on a foreign trip in a few days, and Omer couldn't see that he'd leave the situation in Gezi as it was now and just go. The government was furious about the protest. Omer looked across at Suleiman, who was smoking out of his window, and wondered what he thought. He was a distant member of the deposed royal family, and so he had to approve of what some were calling the new Ottomanism that was sweeping the national consciousness. The government were actively promoting the notion of being proud to be Turkish and doing things in a uniquely Turkish way with pride. This was all good, but much of the new Ottomanism rhetoric was also connected to religion. And also, perversely, to a type of consumerism that would seem to be completely opposed to the tenets of Islam. People were better off, but what the Gezi protesters were asking was, at what cost? Suleiman was bored. While his old friend Igmen was engaged in a race against time to find a newborn child, he was stuck with an historical case involving a skeleton that was over 50 years old. He wasn't involving himself in it any more than he had to, which meant that Omer was really on his own. The body could have been that of a homeless man. Enough of them died violently every year, and always had, except for the complicated dentistry. How had a man with expensive teeth come to be buried under a tree in the grounds of a posh kid's school? Galatasaray had been very cooperative, and had sent over whatever they had about missing teachers or pupils over the years very quickly. But that left nothing unexplained. On the one hand, the dead man was a nobody, and yet on the other, he couldn't be. And then it came to Omer. What was the key to this conundrum was, of course, teeth.
"I would never say that anything was impossible, Inspector," Professor Bozdar said. "But it is unlikely that a tunnel exists underneath Hagia Sophia, leading to the Church of St. Mary of the Mongols in Fener. I accept, however, that the story has been around for many centuries."
Although he was listening to the academic, Hickman couldn't help looking up into the great dome, flanked by mosaic angels, their wings decorated with gold leaf.
"We know that tunnels do exist under this building," Bozdar continued. "One that leads in the direction of the Topkapı Palace, and another that goes off towards Sultan Ahmed Square. Which makes sense. The emperors were often at risk from their people,
and so it would have been of great benefit to them to be able to travel to the Great Palace and to the Hippodrome unobserved. The last time the cavities underneath this building were explored was